This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Futuro.
Dear listener, there's going to be some language that might be offensive in this episode.
I don't think I identified as prominently as Latino as I do now. But for me, it's always going to be Black. I think apparently recently some people started capitalizing Black. And I was like, is it not capitalized? Because I've been doing that since elementary school. I like to call myself Blatino, like with a capital B.
Blatino, yeah. I should do that. The thing about it is that we were never separated from being Black. We always knew we were Black, and it wasn't just because of the color of our skin. It was our culture.
From Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, a year after George Floyd's murder, a family lets us into an intimate conversation about race and Latinidad. On May 25th, 2020, George Floyd, a dad and a friend to so many people, was choked to death in Minneapolis by a white police officer, Derek Chauvin. His murder sparked outrage across the United States and beyond. In the middle of a shutdown and a global pandemic, George Floyd's murder focused attention once again on the systemic racism so many people are experiencing daily in this country at the hands of the police. His death also sparked difficult conversations within the Latino community, where race is still often a taboo in many families. Or, at a minimum, race can be a very uncomfortable conversation. A year after George Floyd's death and the massive protests that followed, we wanted to bring you a family conversation on race and Latinidad. Today, we're joined by two Afro-Latino cousins. First, there's Umar Malik Williams.
My name is Umar Malik Williams. I am 45 years old.
Umar is a musician and radio host. He's lived in the Twin Cities for close to 20 years, and he's been involved in the racial justice movement in Minnesota for years. And this is his younger cousin, Alex Newton.
My name is Alexander Mensa Newton. I am 31 years old.
Alex is a strategy and analytics consultant, and he lives in Washington, D.C. Umar and Alex are maternal cousins.
Both of our mothers are sisters.
Their mothers grew up together in Panama.
They were born in Panama City, lived on 13th Street.
Calle 13.
But Umar and Alex's Black identity doesn't end there. It's much more complex. Umar's father is from Guyana in South America, and Alex's father is from Ghana in Africa.
I grew up Black is beautiful. We are Black here in the United States. We are Black in Central America, Black in South America, Black in the Caribbean, regardless of the language. Our family is very, very incredibly proud of being Panamanian, being Latinos. We cousins are the only ones that don't speak as much Spanish or any Spanish at all.
I speak Spanish. I didn't learn it from home, but I learned it eventually.
Right. Same here. They didn't speak to us in Spanish that much until we had to learn in school.
Umar and Alex grew up close in New York and in New Jersey. In a tight-knit family of 11 cousins, they still chat all the time on their phones.
We cousins considered ourselves siblings. There was no such thing as a nuclear family with us. And we were also steeped in who we were as Black people and as Latinos.
In this conversation, Umar and Alex are going to dig into their nuanced relationship with race, culture, and identity. It's the kind of conversation that probably many Afro-Latino families were having even before George Floyd's murder. But among Latinos who are not Black, this was a moment to engage in these kinds of talks as well. Umar and Alex begin their conversation by remembering that tragic day. Here's Umar, who was in Minneapolis.
It was kind of chilly, kind of rainy Memorial Day, as it always is out here in the cities. Prince was right. Sometimes it snows in April. It did snow that April. We had a little bit of a cold snap. It started to get warmer again. We're like, ooh, Memorial Day is going to be fun. And then we wake up to that.
Following breaking news this midday, and we have just learned the name of the man who died while in Minneapolis police custody late last night. He is George Floyd.
It's weird for me. I honestly don't know. I don't have a specific memory of when I first discovered that George Floyd was murdered, because I have so many memories of Black men being killed by police in the streets. I was thinking about it for a while, and I was just like, I don't know what got white people so excited about this particular one, because this has been happening. You know, Trayvon Martin was not a drug dealer, was not a big, threatening, quote-unquote, Black man. He's a 16-year-old kid getting Skittles in an iced tea. It happens every day. People get shot every day. I was just surprised that George Floyd became such a movement.
Right. I think what's important is that there's a series of circumstances. I could whittle off the names of people who were brutalized to death or shot and killed by Minneapolis or St. Paul police. The significance with me about George Floyd was the full camera footage. About a year before George Floyd was Kobe Heisler. There was no cam footage of that. What happens with a lot of the other murders also is that the timestamp is too quick. For example, Philando Castile, the first video we see is his girlfriend's cam video of it already happening. And it happened within a couple of minutes. Right before Philando Castile was Jamar Clark. Again, dash cam footage. You don't hear what's going on. It's really confusing what's happening. You see a flash of light, and then you see a body put into the paddy wagon. The same thing with what happened with Micaiah Bryant. And we still see the body cam footage. It's 20 seconds long. He shows up, bam, 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 she down on the ground. So all these things are like just rapid fire. And you don't have a chance to really process. It's a different kind of disbelief. George Floyd, over 9 minutes. And you're seeing his humanity. And then you see the callous treatment of his body.
Part of me was starting to think, that's definitely what changed it, is that people could see Chauvin was looking directly at the camera. If you're gonna bang, 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 most people like try and avoid the camera, or they're like, turn the cameras off. But it was just so brazen and in your face. The time thing is definitely part of it. Then you think back to Eric Garner, and that was 70 years ago. And it's like the whole I can't breathe movement, like creating all these hashtags and these new quotes that are hip and cool and easy snippets to capture this system every time. It's hard to identify it as a unique moment because, you know, we've been here, done that. It's again and again and again and again.
It's true, man. It's true.
Umar, I do have a question for you. Do you think if the pandemic wasn't this year and people didn't want an excuse or desire to leave the house, that they would have protested as strong?
That's a very good question. That's a very good question, yeah.
I've been trying to think about what finally mobilized white people, because maybe they just wanted to get, not to, you know, discredit people, but maybe people just wanted to get out the house.
I mean, yeah. Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. Because there was so, man, okay.
I don't know if it makes me more comfortable or less comfortable, but like.
No, you don't need to find a way to justify it or find validity in it because it is valid. And not that there weren't white people protesting the streets when Jamar Clark happened, when Philando Castile happened, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But then we stopped. And fine. If it took a pandemic that people still deny, then cool. Finally. I'm still holding people's feet to the fire about it, but I think the other thing that really helped in the mobilization is people taking control of that intersection. It was something that had never been done. George Floyd Square, that was a game changer. The occupying of that intersection was the real deal. Out in West Side St. Paul and East Side St. Paul is a big Latin community, and they've always been on the forefront of organizing and protesting. We've always connected ourselves as Black and Brown folk. And it's not just the Black and Brown people, it's the white people there too. And we want to blame the pandemic? Cool, because at least people have mobilized and organized in a small fashion. As much as we've been mobilizing and organizing for over 7 years, finally, we've organized and mobilized to take ownership, autonomous ownership, and create a sacred space for us to say, this is ours. And if you're going to try to take it, we ain't going to just let you take it. We put some real fear into the police force by destroying the third precinct. My daughter's mom, she lives 5 blocks away from the third precinct. And the high school that my daughter went to is right there. But to give a full visual, you walk in and then there's the major mural that everybody knows of George Floyd's face and chest, and then all the names, and it's so beautiful. I actually witnessed the creation of this mural. Across the street where Dragon Walk is, where he was first removed from his vehicle, and right in the center there is the big papier-mâché fist, and it's grown to be what it is now. Right where he was killed, there's an outline of his body painted, but like as a chalk outline. And there's a lot of pictures, paintings, prayers, blessings, flowers, everything surrounding there. There's a manifesto, the People's Manifesto about the abolishment of police. On the street, the names, full-on names, George Floyd, Sandra Bland, Jamar Clark, all the names that we've been hearing since Trayvon. And it became this thing that is like a monument now.
God of the Bible is tired of the fact that we can't breathe.
I was in D.C.
God of the Bible is tired of innocent blood being shed. Lift it up. Let him hear you.
I had just started a data science boot camp, and I'm sitting in front of the computer, and I'm staring at the screen, and I'm like, what the hell am I doing in a basement staring at a computer, typing hello world into Python when there's huge protests outside for my people being killed? It's like, what the hell are you doing? Get the hell up and go out and protest. So I finally made it out 1 week. I went down to Black Lives Matter Plaza with a couple of Black friends of mine as well. It was weird because the fence leading up to the White House was covered in memorial. There was a lot of tributes to the several dozen Black people that had been killed by police violence. And there were people that were actively curating that museum content, so to speak. The whole like occupation of a space was a big thing that was different about those protests. Mayor Bowser basically, right in front of the White House when Trump was in office, renamed that entire plaza Black Lives Matter Plaza. Two Washington, D.C. avenues worth of blocks spelled out Black Lives Matter, leading up to as close as you can get to the White House. But it was the first time I had seen an official capacity support for the Black Lives Matter movement. It didn't happen with Trayvon Martin. No mayors, no governors, nobody spoke out about these moments in their official capacity. And then I got there, it felt weird. It felt like the protest part of it had faded away and we had now leaned into protest tourism. And I felt like a protest tourist taking pictures, even though I personally just want, you know, I want to be able to tell my little niece what it felt like being in Washington, D.C. during the George Floyd protests. Even though I was Black and there to celebrate Black lives, once you got there, it's like, okay, so what am I doing about this, right? Like, it's one thing to document, but this is, what's the next step?
It's one of those things that is a fine line, because you also want to honor and respect those who are there to document, to see it. At the same time, are you here to look at this as a museum and post on social media about how cool it is that you're here? What is your purpose?
In that moment, a lot of it was, you know, it's not for social media. And the only thing that got me through the tears and the data science boot camp and sitting in front of a computer is that the most effective thing I can do to just demonstrate Black Lives Matter is to demonstrate Black excellence, Black beauty. I think the only thing that got me through taking those pictures with my friends was, you know, this is for me. This is to reinforce strength in my identity because no one else is going to do it for me. What I was giving is to the future. It's to the next generation.
State of Minnesota plaintiff versus Derek Michael Chauvin, defendant. Verdict, count one. We, the jury, in the above entitled matter as to count one, unintentional second degree murder while committing a felony, find the defendant guilty. Verdict, count two. Guilty. Three. Guilty.
All three counts!
It came, some tears flowed, breathed a bit, and then I'm like, yeah, cool. What's next? And we have a cousin chat.
I'm not going to lie, Umar, I put you guys on mute for a bit. I don't know if I was working or what I was doing.
No, it's all good. It's all good.
I joke about muting you guys, but part of it, too, is just like how much of it can you take? I remember sitting in front of a computer and crying, and it doesn't feel good. And despite how many times we've been through it, it still does not feel great. The only thing I want to hear about this trial is if and when Chauvin is in jail and not getting out. That's what I want to hear, because that's the effective stuff that matters, right? I will go through the re-traumatization of that experience if that's the outcome. I'm not going to re-engage with all this stuff. It's just to hear sentencing in 8 weeks in his New York home on a ranch where he has to wear a bracelet and can't leave a 45-acre radius. And then he's up for like probation in 2 years. Like, I'm not going to re-engage with that unless I hear the actual verdict.
Realistically, I just need money away from the police. I would like for this to actually be a catalyst. I don't want police reform. I want a full restructuring to abolishment of police. Learning a new way of dealing with conflict and preserving life and culture. Let's all be able to have food. Let's all be able to have a home. Let's all be able to communicate, making sure that everybody can live.
Coming up on Latino USA, Umar and Alex discuss some of their struggles with race and Latinidad as they were growing up. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for Latino USA comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/latino. That's odoo.com/latino. Odoo. Modern management made simple.
Hey, we're back. Afro-Latino cousins, Umar Williams and Alex Newton, continue their conversation about race and Latinidad 1 year after George Floyd's murder. And now they're going to go deep into their childhood and their teenage years. And also a quick note, you'll notice some difference in the sound quality in this part of the conversation because it was recorded on a different day and in quarantine, so still not in a studio. Here are Umar and Alex again.
I grew up in Brooklyn, born in 1975, golden age of hip hop, a lot of, you know, the crack era. Alex, you guys are Brunswick, Princeton Junction area.
Yeah, Jersey.
Jersey.
We grew up in New Jersey. So it seems kind of like our parents like ran away to the suburbs to avoid the crack era. One thing I will throw in is that my dad is actually from Ghana. He and my mother met in New York. My mom used to explain when we were younger. My dad dragged her away from her family in the city and we moved into New Jersey. I grew up very closely with my African cousins. So the Newton side of the family, they were literally a bike ride away. The one interesting thing I will say about, you know, the Black culture is, and especially given the time that my parents were born and the time that they decided to move, is this whole idea of Pan-Africanism. In the 60s, all these African countries were gaining independence. I think Marcus Garvey was huge.
Within the last 4 years, the Universal Negro Movement Association has worked wonders.
And there's this whole movement and feeling of Pan-Africanism that extended itself into Jamaica and Barbados, made its way into Panama, obviously. And I think that's what my mother was very much totally into. You know, she got herself some kente cloth, got herself an African husband, and like really leaned into the whole idea of, you know, Black people being united across the world.
And what's funny is that your mom, she reps Panama like nobody's business, man. She's like, Viva Panama! You know, all about Panama. But is, you know, definitely steeped in that Pan-Africanism and the extension of preserving culture. My mother is the same way.
I always grew up thinking we were West Indian before we were Latino, right? The whole Latino part of it, because we go to West Indian Day Parade.
Which is always an event for our family. Our grandparents' home was literally blocks away from the epicenter of the parade. It's mostly the West Indian Caribbean energy and culture, you know, Trinidadians and Jamaicans and St. Lucians and, you know, all that. But there's also Panamanians and Puerto Ricans and Cubans and Dominicans, and brought the celebration of Carnival into that strip of the parkway. It was a way for us all to gather together and celebrate, you know, who we are.
Right. And the minority identity with which you probably most frequently identify is the one that's most attacked. For me, growing up in New Jersey, first of all, you look at me and people are like, you're Black. And nobody's like, oh, your dad's Ghanaian. I mean, if they can figure out that Africa is not a country, nobody's going to specify that your dad's Ghanaian. And it's, even for Panama, for Latinos, like, people aren't used to seeing a Black Latino. Umar was talking about, you know, how we always grew up knowing that we were Black. For us, it was Black first. And for me, just when I started being able to have a memory, we had just moved into a house in one of these white Italian suburbs. This is North Brunswick. And I don't remember exactly how it happened, but as soon as we moved in, people broke into our house and wrote, get out, on our wall.
I remember that distinctly.
Yeah, I mean, if you can explain it, you probably know better than I do.
Yeah, you were very young when that happened. That was literally like the day or the day after you guys moved in. I came to visit with my mom. We wanted to see what was going on. And again, we're a close-knit family. You mess with one, you're going to mess with the whole family. So we coming in, we ready. I was just in college at that time. No, I was in high school. And spray painted all over the world, every room, every room. Get out, get out. They just moved in there. And it was really the first time my younger cousins, the Newton cousins, had ever had to really experience it that blatantly. I'm from Brooklyn. Dealt with the cops a lot. I've been called before. I've been called baboon, monkey, got into a few fights in my youth because of that. But his parents made sure that they were as sheltered from that experience as possible.
I can't see it visually. And maybe it's one of those things that my parents told me directly after that. But my twin brother Ryan, like, we grew up just being kids, not being Black kids until, like, that memory was brought forth. And it's like, we didn't really talk too much about race. It's always this balance, you know, in Black families of how long can I let my child grow up with the naive ignorance that is just being a child and a human being before the conversation. In the 90s, there is this debate of African-American and where we put the dashes and if we capitalize certain things. And I never wanted to be called African-American. I was always like, Black is the way to go. I don't have to separate myself from African-Americans, quote unquote, or from Black Latinos or whatever.
I despised being called African-American, not because I didn't connect to being African. You look at us, we go down to Africa. So that was understood. That was always understood. My mother made sure that was always understood with me. So we don't need to be reminded of the continent. It lumped us all in a way that we didn't need to be lumped in. And erased a lot of who we are. I agree with, like, Whoopi Goldberg. I'm not from Africa. I'm Black. I'm not even going to call myself Black American. I'm Black. Plain and simple. If anybody's African-American, it's my cousins, because their father's from Ghana.
Yeah, probably like most directly African-American.
Right, exactly. Exactly. If you're going to call somebody African-American, you could call the Newtons African-American because their father's from Ghana, but their mother's from Panama, so you can't just call them that, okay? They Latin, you know? Yeah. We don't play that. Nobody gets to tell you who you are.
Except our moms.
Right. Exactly. Not even our dads. Only
I was thinking about when I discovered my Latinidad. It's hard because probably the only reason that I realized that I was Latino was because I grew up saying Panama. And when you go to school, they say Panama. I get to school and people are like, why do you say it that way? I was like, why do you say it that way? That's not the name of the country. Like, that was like probably the only thing I knew about my Latinidad as I was growing up. I never really leaned into my Latino identity until I was able to reconcile the Blackness part of it. That didn't come until college, actually. Africa and Latin America have all these commonalities from a development perspective to start, but also just from like a colonization perspective, from language perspectives between like whether it's like French in Africa or English in Africa and Spanish in Latin America. They have all these similarities. When I realized that, oh, wait, both of these people were oppressed in the same way, that's who I am. That's when I realized my Latinidad. It's probably slightly different for you, Omar.
The difference was my mom was very steeped in her Latinidad. All of the siblings, as we call them, they spoke to each other in Spanish. The Panamanian Spanish, which is different from Puerto Rican, which is different from Cuban. There's definitely a West Indian inflection in the words.
Yeah, it's very confusing.
Yeah. And they spoke to each other in Spanglish, their version of Spanglish.
Yeah, it's a particular brand of Spanglish, West Indian Spanglish.
It's a particular... specific kind, a lot of diamonds, you know. You know, my mother made sure that I knew my culture, and there was a pride about it. You know, we knew our music, we knew the language, we knew our history. A big thing about our family is understanding where we come from. Also, be strong. Don't be afraid of who you are. As much as people will look at you and say, you're not, you can say, yes, the hell I am.
Yeah, I didn't even take it a step farther. I had an Argentinian friend in high school, and I was like, His last name is De Benedetti, and he was white and with blue eyes. I was like, I'm confused. You say you're Argentinian, but you're white as hell. Like, are you?
Well, Argentinians are a bit different.
No, that's totally fair. That's totally fair. But I was like, I know I'm Latino. What the hell are you? You claim to be Latino, and I claim to be Latino. I don't know how we both like happen to be Latino under the same umbrella. I had grown up presuming that Latinos were black or some kind of mixed brownish, like a person of color. And then I started meeting white Latinos and I was so confused. Like, I guess the tough part of seeing this Argentine was you can claim to be just as different as I am just because you're also Latino. But it's like when he goes to Spain and speaks Spanish, people aren't doubting your identity based on solely your appearance.
Right. We both had the experience of having to actually prove ourselves, which is a difficult thing when that's how you've grown up and that's how you identify. There's another way of survival, how to navigate through this life as an Afro-Latino.
I have to say, I had a conversation just the other day with my roommate around all of this concept of being black and being white. If I had the choice to be born again and I could choose my race, I would choose blackness again. And he's like, well, you know, if you look at the data, you look at the graphs, and you look at the odds of like being pulled over, being arrested, being killed, and all of that, not to just throw it in there lightly, but like, why would you choose to be black again? But where something happens, you know, if it's the Watts riots in LA, if it's Derek Chauvin's trial today, black people are not surprised because we've grown up with this perspective. A lot of white people have to learn to have perspective, and that's something that's just baked into being black, into being other. My identity is always different. I'm always the one out because people can see you before they can hear you. We know the depth of all of this stuff. It's not just the small stuff. It's not just the brazen stuff like having your house spray painted. It's not just people crossing the street and clutching their purses. It's this whole invisible thing that you can't see. For a lot of white people, they don't experience that. They don't see how the zip codes are codified into Jim Crow. People don't see that and they don't experience it because they're not denied a home loan. But people, like, for every step of our lives, you know, it's every little thing. There's always so many times like that stuff can happen where it's like, okay, we're not deceived. So all the perspective that you get from that, I mean, it's something that can't be taught. It's something that can't be learned. It's something that we grew up in that's baked into our culture and the way we were raised and just the small moments of pride just as being a black person. But I think just to bring it back to the pride thing too, I think it makes us stronger. For every scab that you get, for every cut that you get, the skin that regrows is stronger than the skin that was there before.
What is really good about finding and living in blackness in all the forms that we have is that we have been able to live and navigate in a way that has us understanding who we are and not being ashamed of it, not staring away from it, but fully embracing it and fully being a part of it. All of it. All of it. All of it is who we were, and all of it was rich, and all of it was beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. And don't let anybody, whether they look like you or they look like your oppressors, ever take that away from you.
Our thanks to Umar and Alex for sharing their thoughts with us.
Thank you.
This episode was produced by Maria Esquinca and edited by Marta Martinez. The Latino USA team includes Miguel Macias, Andrea López Cruzado, Mike Sargent, Julieta Martinelli, Victoria Estrada, Ginny Montalvo, Alejandra Salazar, Reynaldo Leaños Jr., and Julia Rocha, with help from Raúl Pérez. Our engineers are Stephanie LeBeau, Julia Caruso, and Leah Shaw. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. Our intern is Oscar de León. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. If you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, I'll see you on all of our social media. Ahí los veo. Bye.
Latino USA is made possible in part by W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first. The Chan Zuckerberg Initiative. And the Heising Simons Foundation, unlocking knowledge, opportunity, and possibilities. More at hsfoundation.org.
My mom was like, if we have to celebrate the Catholic holidays and the Jewish holidays, we're going to celebrate Black holidays too. You ain't going to school for Black Solidarity Day. And don't worry about it. I'm not going to work either. And I'm going to teach you about being Black.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, a year after its scheduled release, In the Heights hits theaters across the country. I speak with director John M. Chu about why he thinks immigrant narratives deserve to be summer blockbusters.
The best parts are the struggle, because that's how you see how tough everyone is. That's how you see how much people care about each other.
That's next time on Latino USA.
From PRX.